It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule for Tuesday, January 15th. Happy meteorological midwinter. Today on the podcast, 13, a lucky 13 items of interest, from electronic pull tabs to bike vehicle crashes to early childhood education. We started off with a new Department of Public Safety report out today. It outlines a vision for treating and sheltering youth victims of sex trafficking. Laura Ewan has covered the story extensively.
Lawmakers mandated the report when they passed the so-called Safe Harbor Act 3 years ago. The law requires authorities to treat sexually exploited children as kids in need of help, not as delinquents. The panel of prosecutors, police, advocates, and others is recommending a $13 million plan. Jeff Bauer is with the advocacy group The Family Partnership. Bauer says most of the money, about $8 million, would go toward housing.
You can't just take these kids and throw them into the general population of a homeless and runaway youth shelter or something like that. They really need a higher level of security. They need a higher level of therapeutic service.
Bauer says there are just a handful of beds in the state dedicated to sexually exploited youth. Advocates are expected to ask the legislature for about $10 to $11 million to help build the system.
Laura Ewan in St. Paul, now Dan Crocker in Duluth, with a report. A federal appeals court has ruled against the city of Duluth in its long-running contract dispute with the Fond du Lac Band over its downtown casino.
In 1986, Duluth and the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa teamed up on the Fond Duluth Casino, the first downtown tribal casino in the country. In 1994, they agreed Duluth would receive 19% of the casino's slot revenues, about $6 million a year. But in 2009, the band stopped paying, arguing the deal violated federal law requiring tribes to have the sole proprietary interest in their casinos. The lower court, and now a three-judge panel of the Eighth Circuit Court, agree the deal is illegal. Duluth Mayor Don Ness says at stake is more than $12 million the band withheld, plus millions in future revenues.
The consequences to the taxpayers and the residents of the city of Duluth are far-reaching and devastating.
Duluth plans to appeal the decision to the full Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Dan Crocker in Duluth. In St. Cloud, the city's Economic Development Authority is recommending tax incentives for a new farm implement plant. Conrad Wilson reports.
The German company Geringhoff announced last fall it would open its first North American plant in St. Cloud and hire 100 workers. The Economic Development Authority recommends the company get a $500,000 forgivable loan from the state, as well as nearly $1 million in tax incentives as part of the Jobsy program. Kathy Mihelich is the city's Economic Development Director.
It includes corporate franchise tax savings, sales tax savings, state and local property tax exemptions, as well as a tax credit for jobs created on the project site.
The company's application still needs to be approved by the city council.
That's Conrad Wilson in St. Cloud, now Minneapolis, and a Curtis Gilbert report on bicycle safety. The city says drivers and cyclists are both to blame in many bike vehicle crashes.
In a study released today, the city found crashes usually happen when one or both parties fail to yield to the right-of-way or otherwise ignore the rules of the road. Cyclists were to blame in about 60% of crashes, as were drivers, meaning oftentimes both parties were at fault. The vast majority of crashes occurred within 50 feet of an intersection. Minneapolis analyzed almost 3,000 crashes that took place over a 10-year period. Only a dozen of them were fatal. The city averages about 270 bike vehicle crashes every year. That number has stayed relatively constant over the last decade, even as the number of bicycle commuters in the city increased by almost 75%. City staff recommend improving the design of intersections and bike lanes, as well as increased education efforts for drivers and cyclists.
That's Curtis Gilbert on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Faculty union reps for Minnesota's seven state universities have reached a tentative contract agreement with MNSCU officials. Alex Friedrich has more.
Interfaculty Organization President Nancy Black says the two-year agreement would give all faculty a 2.2% raise going back to this past fall. She says it's the first such across-the-board pay increase that members have received in 4 years.
It is a really big deal because they are struggling in this economy, just like the majority of Minnesotans.
She says it would also be the first time the contract included adjunct and full-time probationary faculty. Minsky Chancellor Stephen Rosenstone said in a press release he believes a completed agreement is essential to recruit and retain high-quality faculty. Minsky faculty are scheduled to vote on the contract early next month.
Alex Friedrich follows higher education for Minnesota Public Radio News. Now to lower education and State Capitol reporter Tim Pugmire. He says early childhood programs are the latest in a growing list of education spending proposals. New DFL-controlled legislators appear ready to consider this session, a list that already adds up to several hundred million dollars. Here's Tim.
A statewide coalition of nonprofit groups and businesses known as Mini Minds unveiled a request for $185 million over the next 2 years to fund preschool scholarships aimed at children in poverty. During a state capitol event Monday to launch the campaign, Nancy Jost of the West Central Initiative in Fergus Falls said action is needed soon.
Now is the time to address the most critical issue preventing Minnesota kids from being adequately prepared for school. It's time to make access to quality early care and education programs a priority.
Several education funding proposals are expected to get attention this session, but DFL leaders in the House and Senate have so far set distinctly different strategies for helping schools. The new DFL majority in the Minnesota House declared its commitment to public education last week with the first bill of the session. House File 1 pays back about half of the $1 billion owed to schools from previous budget deals. Freshman DFL Representative Yvonne Seltzer of Minnetonka is the bill's author.
It's important that we start off by saying we're going to keep our commitment, and paying back half of it or making that commitment to look at that is our firm down payment on that promise.
Republican Representative Kelby Woodard of Belle Plaine said he supports the payback, but he also wants to make it a lot harder for lawmakers to pass another school payment delay in the future. Woodard introduced legislation requiring a 60% majority on such votes.
We already require a three-fifths majority whenever we borrow money on our bonds, and so we should require that same threshold when we would borrow from our schools.
Senate Democrats included all-day kindergarten among their first bills of the session, but not a school shift payback. The Senate measure would provide about $170 million a year to school districts to offer all-day kindergarten as a voluntary program. DFL Senator Chuck Wieger of Maplewood, the chair of the Senate Education Finance Committee, said the option should be available statewide.
It should not be based on the wealth of a district as to whether you have kindergarten or not. This is the 21st century, and that's why it's being proposed. Let's get that together.
But Republican Senator Sean Nenow of Cambridge said he thinks Democrats will have a big problem delivering on all their campaign promises this year. With the state already facing a projected $1.1 billion deficit, Nenow said the only way the DFL majority can follow through on its growing education wish list is to raise taxes a lot.
Now they can do anything they want, and if they do, they won't be back in their majorities again, because Minnesota's not looking for a $6 or a $7 or an $8 billion tax increase. So I think you're going to see these bills. They're going to go in, but you're just not going to have the money to fund it all. It just isn't going to be there.
DFL leaders in the House and Senate share at least one big goal for education. They want to make local property taxes a smaller piece of the school funding puzzle. DFL Representative Paul Marquardt of Dilworth, chair of the House Education Finance Committee, said school districts rely too much on local tax levies to pay for operating expenses.
What that has created is great disparities among the property-rich districts and the property-poor districts. And so it's beginning to a point where the quality of your education is depending on your zip code. That has to be reversed.
The Education, Finance, and Tax Committees in both chambers are expected to start digging into the local levy issue soon. Lawmakers will find out next week if DFL Governor Mark Dayton includes any of the same education finance initiatives in his two-year budget proposal.
Tim Pugmire at the State Capitol. The Rules Committee in the Minnesota House has rebuffed efforts to move oversight of the agriculture finance budget from the Environment, Natural Resources, and Agriculture Finance Committee. Republicans have been pushing for that change, saying the issue is too important to be lumped into a larger committee that is chaired by a Minneapolis Democrat. Republican Representative Rod Hamilton of Mountain Lake says combining environmental policies with ag issues sends the wrong message to rural Minnesota.
But I've been sent up here to do a job. It's not my district. It's the district that I have the pleasure to represent, and it happens to be an ag district. And you know what? It is about time that the ag members start standing up for themselves.
Democrats say the move is not a slight to rural Minnesota, and they believe the chair, Representative Gene Wagenius, will handle ag issues appropriately. DFLer John Purcell of Bemidji says he's offended by suggestions Democrats aren't focused on rural issues.
Good golly, we ought to be able to at least have the conversation and take it to the committees that we have set up. Natural resources, crying out loud, that's got a lot to do with agriculture. And I agree with somebody else said ag is stewardship.
DFL House leaders also say a rural member chairs the House Agriculture Policy Committee. Well, you might have thought the discussion of a new Viking stadium at the Capitol was over last May, but the financing plan for the new stadium is off to a slow start. Tim Nelson says a House committee is assessing its progress this week at the state Capitol.
If you're wondering who's really going to pay for the new Viking stadium, talk with John Latcham. His Shoreview company, Three Diamond Gaming Supplies, is the biggest pull-tab supplier in the state and one of two currently licensed to distribute new electronic pull-tabs and bingo. His games will be blinking and flashing in bars and restaurants around the state. Taxes on those games help pay the state's share of the Viking Stadium.
I know people want to see money coming in large piles to build a great big stadium for the Vikings, and we all want to see that happen.
Revenues since the pull tab started on September 18th are falling far short of the $100 million a month target experts initially set for the games. Last month, disappointing revenues prompted state finance officials to cut the expected stadium cash they'd have on hand by half. The most current data from the Minnesota Gambling Control Board show Minnesotans only played a total of $4.1 million worth of the games through the end of 2012. And by New Year's Eve, there were just 386 machines up and running, a fraction of the 15,400 e-pull tab devices projected to eventually be in play. The existing machines are also each grossing less per day than the projection experts made when the stadium financing plan was being hammered out last spring. Tom Barrett is the executive director of the Minnesota Gambling Control Board, which approves the games.
The critical point is just the lack of sites. And again, we got about a potential pool of 2,500 sites, and as of today, we're in at about 120, 118 sites.
Barrett says his agency is moving the process along as quickly as the law allows, but he cites a variety of hurdles for gambling operators. The complexity of the electronic games, the need for secure internet equipment, and requirements in statute, like having paper pull tabs with electronic games, all have tripped up early adopters. Barrett says it can't have been any other way.
We want to make sure that the games that are out there in play have the utmost integrity, but this is a new format. It's not just a simple print the paper game. There's a lot to go into the electronics and the programming and the accounting.
Proponents have offered a variety of suggestions to get things going faster, from adding regulatory staff to speed up licensing, to rethinking the requirement that paper pull tabs be offered as well as electronic games. DFL State Representative Joe Atkins of Invergrove Heights chairs a House committee that oversees charitable and horse track gambling, among other things. He says it's too soon to commit to making any changes to the stadium plan or pull tab regulations.
Well, I think first things first, which is we ought to make sure that we have the full, complete picture of what's going on before we start talking about making changes and doing different things. That's not to say we won't, but I just think it makes a lot of sense to get all the information first.
Dwayne Benson is a former Republican Senate Minority Leader, an NFL veteran and member of the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority, the state chartered agency building the new stadium. He agrees that lawmakers should let pull tabs play out a little longer.
They got plenty on their platter. They know how that stretches them out to go through stadium discussions again, and I told you so arguments and all those other things. So the legislators I've talked to, the last thing they want to do is reopen that can.
And sellers think that the state will see more revenue in coming months.
I think it'll be faster than most people anticipate.
Latcham, the pull tab distributor, says the market is still largely untapped and the money will come, particularly when electronic bingo is approved, possibly later this month.
We've put some ETABS insights already that we might have projected as potentially being marginal, and we were wrong by a mile. Some of the figures that are coming in compared to what they were doing in paper are just phenomenal.
And with the growth of electronic games expected to more than double the size of Minnesota's charitable gambling industry in the next 2 years, phenomenal may be what it takes.
Tim Nelson there at the state capitol. State legislation would place stricter requirements on debt collectors who file lawsuits against consumers. Attorney General Lori Swanson says debt collectors often file lawsuits with questionable evidence. She says sometimes they target the wrong person.
What should the debt buyers have to show? They should have to have admissible evidence of the debtor. Number two, they should have evidence of the debt, that that person actually owes this amount of money. And number three, the debt buyer should have proof that it owns the debt. Essentially, the bill tells debt buyers you need to prove your case to win your case. It's as simple as that.
Swanson recently announced a settlement in a lawsuit against the debt buyer Midland, which she accused of using robo-signed affidavits to get judgments against consumers. Minneapolis Park forestry crews are cutting down hundreds of ash trees at the Fort Snelling Golf Club this week. As Matt Sepik reports, it's the result of an emerald ash borer infestation found months ago.
Workers found evidence of emerald ash borers in about 100 trees at the golf course last summer. But Park Board Forestry Director Ralph Sievert says they're removing four times as many because nearby ash trees are probably infested too. He says winter's the best time to do the work.
If you are planning on removing an ash tree or working on like pruning an ash tree, this is the time of year to do it because the beetle's not active, as opposed to doing it in the summertime when you could unknowingly be moving the beetle around, and that's one of the things you don't want to do.
Sievert says about half the ash trees are on the playing area of the golf course. The others are in the woods to the side. He says wood from about 30 of the large ash trees will be milled into lumber.
That's Matt Sepik on the NPR News Update. Now Martin Moylan on business. He says Twin Cities-based St. Jude Medical has received a warning letter from the Federal Food and Drug Administration.
The warning concerns testing and staff training shortcomings found at a St. Jude plant in California. That facility develops wires that connect an implantable defibrillator to a patient's heart. Industry consultant David Furr says warning letters typically indicate FDA displeasure with the company's response or a decision. The matter involved is significant enough to warrant a formal warning for the record.
If they felt like you either didn't understand or didn't adequately respond to the observations, they can certainly issue a warning letter. They'll also issue warning letters if you didn't respond in a timely fashion.
Copies of the letter were not available. The company says the letter doesn't reflect concerns about the safety of any St. Jude product. The firm says it'll work with the agency to resolve the problems. Failure to satisfy the FDA could eventually impair the export of some devices and the approval of new ones. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Now we close with guns. National Rifle Association President David Keene says he'd like lawmakers to pay more attention to treatment for violent, mentally ill people rather than restricting gun rights. Keene was in St. Paul yesterday to deliver the keynote address at a conference on the criminal justice system. He said only a small percentage of people with mental illness act out violently, but he said too often people who show signs of being dangerous to themselves or others don't get treated.
And then when you look at what's happened, the Newtown shooting and all this, almost all of these people that are involved in these things are mentally schizophrenic, or they've been spotted by people. Nobody's done anything about it.
Keene is also a co-founder of the conservative think tank Right on Crime, which co-sponsored yesterday's conference. Keene opposes loosening restrictions on the type of gun information federal law enforcement agencies can release to the public, which some congressional Democrats say would promote more research on firearms deaths and injuries. That's the NPR News Update for January 15. I'll have the Wednesday news right here tomorrow. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for listening.